You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Earlier this year, a group of Colorado lawmakers tried but failed to abolish the death penalty in their state. And this week, the prosecution decided to seek the death penalty for James Holmes, who is on trial for killing 12 and wounding 70 people when he opened fire in a movie theater in Aurora, Colorado. Capital punishment is the law in 33 states, and there are some 3,100 prisoners on death row. Martin Clancy and Tim O'Brien, both veterans of ABC News, Mr. Clancy as a producer and writer and Mr. O'Brien as a law correspondent, have examined how the Supreme Court has grappled with the legitimacy and constitutionality of the death penalty over the years in a book called Murder at the Supreme Court, Lethal Crimes and Landmark Cases. It's published by Prometheus Books. I'm very pleased to welcome Martin Clancy and Tim O'Brien to our show today. Hello.
Thank you for having us.
Nice to be with you.
Capital punishment long predates the founding of the United States, but what was the rationale supporting it in the early decades of our country?
What else was one to do? There were no jails. So what do you do with somebody who steals a calf or beats up his wife? You either fine him or you flog him or you dispatch him.
And so the death penalty was used on all sorts of crimes that we now would never dream of applying it to?
Yes, from witchcraft to whatever.
The motive behind it was much the same today, though, as it was then, and that would be deterrence and retribution. Those have always been factors with capital punishment, but in those days, the retribution for stealing a calf was much greater than it would be today.
But aren't many of the challenges to the death penalty based on the claim that it is cruel and unusual punishment, which is prohibited by the Eighth Amendment?
Yes.
But defining what is cruel and unusual is the challenge, and that has changed over time. It's not just the way the execution is carried out, how the person is executed, but who is executed and what safeguards are in place at the trial and after the trial.
A major issue is that the death penalty has been applied unevenly and unequally, a violation of the 14th Amendment. Can you explain that argument and evidence that's used to uphold it?
The disparities range from race. I mean, for example, you are more likely to be executed if you kill a white person than a black, never mind your own race. Economics, the warden of San Quentin who put 90 people to death, Clinton Duffy, said he never executed a rich man. If you can afford a good defense, you're going to save your life. Tim?
Well, I think the book was not an advocacy book, and we take no position on the morality of capital punishment. But we do take issue with the way it's being carried out, and really, once you've made the tough decision to have the death penalty, you're faced with even tougher decisions as to who is executed. We have about 15,000 homicides in the United States every year. That's down significantly over the last few years, but still quite a few, and they bring about maybe 200 or 300 death sentences. And yet we have about 40 executions a year. The last few years, it's averaged around there. How do you decide? There is no way of predicting what crime or what criminal is going to get a death sentence. And what we've concluded, I mean, some people will say, so long as those who are executed are deserving of capital punishment and others get off, that's no reason for doing away with capital punishment. But, and let's face it, that might make sense. But it's not really that simple. If we had a system that said, pick a card. If you pick the wrong card, you're going to be executed. Nobody would go along with that, but that's kind of the system we have. It's every bit as irrational as that. Nobody knows what crime or what criminal is going to get a death sentence.
So an argument could be made that maybe not every one of those 15,000 killings would end with a death sentence, but maybe 14,000 of them, with a few exceptions for other reasons, extenuating circumstances.
Yes, but the reality is, given the state of play of the death penalty, most of those condemned to death will die of old age.
Because they just stay in on death row waiting for appeal after appeal to be resolved.
In legal limbo.
Well, that's another argument that people have.
If we had more executions, it would be better, right?
Yeah, wouldn't that just clear up things a little bit? Texas seems to believe that.
For capital punishment to be effective, for it really to be a deterrent, like all punishment, it needs to be swift and it needs to be certain. It has never been either. And our system is such. We do have a commitment to due process and to fair play. And we go through hoops to make sure we don't execute innocent people, although we probably have. All those protections may make it impossible to implement capital punishment in a way that is both swift and certain. It certainly isn't that way now. And it's not swift and certain. You look at the purposes of capital punishment, deterrence, retribution, they're not served any better than life in prison would be served. Those are conclusions we make in the end of the book. The book is mostly telling stories about these remarkable cases that got to the Supreme Court. What happened before? What happened after? There's a lot of legal analysis in the book, but it's really, we're telling stories which we found to be quite compelling.
And you open your book with a description of a meeting of Supreme Court justices on March 9th, 1969, about the fate of a condemned Alabama man named William Maxwell. Why was that a potential turning point for how the court handled the death penalty?
Well, in secret, in their conference room facing Second Avenue in Washington, eight of the justices voted that that Alabama statute under which the man had been convicted was unconstitutional. They all came at it from different directions. They all had different reasons, but there was a majority. That constituency didn't hold up for 24 hours. Justice Harlan slept badly that night, apparently, and wrote a note, we found, to the Chief Justice saying that he really wanted to rethink his vote and that the case should be re-argued. In the interim, Justice Fortas left the court. The Chief Justice retired, and the case had to be re-argued the next term. That window into abolition never really opened.
Well, how many states had the death penalty at that point? Hadn't it been pretty much eliminated in this country?
No. In fact, we're up now to 18 states that have abolished it, but very few that practice it actively.
New York, for example, has a death penalty, but it's been a long time since we've had a capital case.
Well, one of the things you're finding is under another Supreme Court decision, which we don't go into in our book in any great detail, the court held that if the defendant is eligible for life without parole, if the jury has that choice, they have to know they can sentence him to life without parole. You can't just leave it up to the judge. And we're finding that juries, given that choice, more often will opt to life without parole. The defendant would pose no threat to the community, or so it's perceived, and they're less likely to hand a death sentence. We find when we have capital punishment, support for it seems to wane. And when we don't have it, support for it seems to rise. I don't know how to explain that, but we seem to be now in that direction where support for it is waning. No states that have abolished it are starting to adopt it, but over the last several years, a handful of states that had it and practiced it are now abolishing it. Maryland, the most recent last month.
And the way it happened in Maryland is interesting. Public opinion still supports the death penalty in Maryland, according to the latest polls, very accurate polls. But the support is what's called soft. The majority of people also feel that capital punishment is not a deterrent. The legislature, apparently the governor actually pushed three times in 2007, 2009, and again this year, and he finally got a majority in the legislature. He will sign the bill shortly.
The case of William Furman came before the Supreme Court in 1972. What are the details of the crime and the sentence in that case?
Tim, I'm going to leave that one to you.
And why did it come before the Supreme Court?
This was actually one of several cases that came up to the Supreme Court at one point. And the justices used that case to say not that capital punishment is unconstitutional per se, but they found that it was being implemented in a way that is wanton and freakish, in the words of Justice Byron White, that no one could tell who would be executed or for what reason. The juries must have some discretion, but they had too much discretion, and too many arbitrary factors were figuring into capital sentencing, an argument that we think is every bit as valid today. So in the Furman case, they threw out the death penalty, and states scrambled to rewrite their death penalty laws in a way that might meet the Supreme Court's objections. So 4 years later, another case comes up involving a guy who's hitching a ride and murders the two guys who give him a ride for the purpose of robbing them.
By the way, also from Georgia.
Also from Georgia.
Greg versus Georgia in this case.
Right. Troy, Greg versus Georgia, which we found to be every bit as interesting and perhaps even more important than the Furman case, because in the Greg case, the Supreme Court looked at what it had said in Furman and found that the Georgia had rewritten its law in a way that met all of its objections. Now, the law and the story behind the case, both important and fascinating. Every state that wanted capital punishment immediately started modeling their laws with a few changes, but mostly they looked very much like Georgia's law, because Georgia's law would fly with the Supreme Court. Greg, he, on the eve of his execution, he escaped. We all thought he would be the first to be executed with the Supreme Court reinstating capital punishment. And in a way, he was. He escaped with four other convicted murderers, widely thought of as among the worst killers in Georgia history. Their crimes are too grotesque to even describe in our book, which has some, a lot of grotesque crimes described in them. But he escaped with the four other inmates, a very daring escape. There was a nationwide manhunt out for them. They went up to North Carolina, got up, connected with some old friends, a motorcycle gang, and Greg made the unfortunate mistake of sliding the girlfriend of one of them, and one of his fellow escapees stomped him to death. His body was found floating in a nearby lake a couple of days later. All the others were later apprehended, but for Greg's daring escape, he got another 24 hours. That's about it.
So how does that wind up coming before the Supreme Court and argued by Robert Bork, who was nominated but not approved for the Supreme Court? He argued for Georgia in that case.
He argued for the United States in support of Georgia. Mm-hmm. And by the way, it's a bit, the oral argument in that case is available on the Internet, and it is fascinating. And Bork was at his very best in that case. The issue was the 1972 decision the beginning of the end of capital punishment? Proponents of capital punishment hoped that it wasn't. Opponents saw this as the opening. That when the Gregg case came up, the big issue was, does this statute meet the definition of the restrictions and the objections that the Supreme Court noted in Furman, or is this the end of capital punishment? And you had, I think it was Tony Amsterdam, one of the New York law professor, one of the leading critics of capital punishment to this day, an esteemed lawyer, arguing this should be it. We've tried it. It doesn't work. And then Bork went on to say, look, just because it doesn't work for many, just because many killers escape it, doesn't mean it's irrational. The argument we were discussing earlier. Bork was terrific, but and he won the case with Georgia, of course. The question was out there, and the court had changed, and it was, I think, 7-2 initially to throw out the death penalty and 5-4 to reinstate it.
And the big difference between Furman and Gregg was that Georgia had rewritten its statutes to provide a dual decision. The jury would make one decision about guilt or innocence and a second about the penalty.
But if you look at death penalty decisions, they often are applied irrationally and unpredictably. So how could Bork argue otherwise?
Well, Bork's central argument was, if it's arbitrary and capricious, it is so only because those who deserve the death penalty don't get it. That's no reason for getting rid of it. And as I said earlier, I do think that would appeal to a lot of people. It's just that when you look at the system, if it's that arbitrary and that capricious, even if everybody might deserve it and only a few get it, if it's going to be as tricky as pick a card, is that the kind of system that we really want? It reflects less on the crime and the criminal than how our system of justice works.
My guests are Tim O'Brien and Martin Clancy. Their book, Murder at the Supreme Court, Lethal Crimes and Landmark Cases, published by Prometheus Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Martin Clancy and Tim O'Brien, both veterans of ABC News. Mr. Clancy as a producer and writer, Mr. O'Brien as the network's longtime law correspondent. They have collaborated on a book called Murder at the Supreme Court, Lethal Crimes and Landmark Cases, published by Prometheus Books, a title that kind of sounds like a mystery novel. But to some people, the whole issue that you're dealing with can be a mystery, why this person and not that person. You point to a landmark case, Lockett versus Ohio from 1975, is remarkable. Why is that case especially important?
Well, in its effort to make the death penalty more streamlined and more predictable, the court in Lockett said you have to consider any mitigating circumstances, anything that might help the defendant. Initially, in Gregg versus Georgia, the court said if there are going to be aggravating circumstances, and there have to be aggravating circumstances for a death sentence, those circumstances have to be spelled out in the law, such as the murder of a police officer, murder in the commission of another felony. In Lockett, they said they don't have to be spelled out in the law. It's open-ended. So you can look into anything that might weigh in favor of the defense. And that was a very controversial decision because the dissenters said, well, we're going right back where we started from again. Now we're going, they're going to really, if they can consider anything in mitigation, then the inquiry really becomes wide open and it's going to become too subjective. The guided discretion is not really guided anymore.
Well, that the judge said that he had no alternative but to apply the death penalty to Sandra Lockett. Because,
that's right.
Because this was like some drug cases where there's a mandatory sentence.
Yeah, in this case, she drove the getaway car. She said, I would have participated. It wasn't supposed to be a murder. She drove the getaway car in the holdup of a jewelry store, and she said, hey, you know, the guy knows me, so I'm going to stay in the car. Now, later decisions said, in that case, she still would not be eligible for the death penalty. But when this case came up, she was. And the case really shows a lot about the court, that, again, they split 5-4, as they did in the Maxwell case, and we're finding in a whole line of capital cases, the death penalty jurisprudence is riddled with 5-4 decisions. They split the court like they really divide the country. And we also found that some of the justices who we learned later, they actually oppose capital punishment, but they voted in favor of it in the Lockett case because they felt the state had the right to do it.
So she was executed?
She was not executed. Her death sentence was set aside when the court said the jury could not consider other mitigating circumstances. They should be, they said you have to consider anything that might weigh in her favor. In the Ohio case, in the Lockett case, the judge instructed the jury under the prior Supreme Court rulings, the mitigating circumstances have to be spelled out in the law. In those cases, and at that time in Ohio, one was you're acting under duress, the person you killed caused you somehow caused you to commit the crime, so, but there were just two or three, and the court used that case to say it has to be open-ended. What happened there, she just was recently released from prison. Her son, even though she has spent very little time with her son was involved in a murder, totally unrelated. It was a robbery, and they pushed a woman out of a car, and she died, and he is now in prison, and she's devoting the rest of her freedom to get her son out of prison for a murder charge.
But her case,
what happens after these decisions is also sometimes quite fascinating.
Her case reminds us that if you are involved in a crime where a death takes place, you are as culpable as the person who actually shot the gun or threw the person out of the car. And often part of the irrationality is that the driver of the car winds up being executed while the person who shot the clerk winds up getting off because he turns state's witness or has a different jury.
Generally speaking, not anymore. That used to happen. But the court more recently ruled that there are stricter criteria for what are called non-trigger men.
And those, it makes it harder to give them the death penalty?
Yes.
Yeah, and those are cases that we also recount in the book. This was a case of some kids who helped their father in a prison break with the promise there would be no violence. And there was tons of violence. So 6 or 7 people were killed as the father and the boys went on a killing spree throughout the Southwest. In that case, the boys were sentenced to death. It went to the U.S. Supreme Court, which said that would be permissible, but you'd have to find that the non-trigger man, in this case the non-trigger boys, acted with reckless indifference to human life and had a underlying role, a principal role in the underlying felony. They had a principal role in the prison break, so that part of the test was satisfied. But whether they acted with reckless indifference to human life went back to the jury.
Well, how has the Supreme Court determined if and how the death penalty can be applied in cases with juvenile defendants? You use the 2004 Supreme Court case Roper versus Simmons as an example. At the time, wasn't the United States the only country in the world that allowed the death penalty to be applied to juveniles?
Yes, that's true.
Actually, at the time that case came up, Israel did as well. But it had not executed any juveniles, and subsequent to the Supreme Court's decision, it repealed that.
What was the argument for applying the death penalty to a juvenile?
That was a 5-4 decision, and it's a very important case, not just on that question, but rather who should be deciding. Should it be the jury? Should it be the state legislature? Or should it be 9 unelected federal judges who served for life?
Or should it be Justice Kennedy, who was a swing vote, as he often has been?
And I believe he was in that case. Yeah. In fact, he wrote the decision in that 5-4 decision. You're right. But the argument is, if you're on the eve of your 18th birthday, you're a cold-blooded killer. Why does that change a week after your 18th birthday? And maybe the jury should be decided. The same issue applies, the same question applies when you're talking about people who are mildly mentally retarded. Maybe it should be up to the jury to make the call as to whether this person should be executed. Clearly, we're not going to execute a 10-year-old, and we're not going to execute an idiot. But in the case of someone who is just barely mentally retarded or almost 18, should those questions be left to the jury, or should the federal court step in?
And Justice Scalia was critical of the ruling. Didn't it undo his majority opinion in another case?
Yes, it did, because he actually, and I hate to see that, the Stanford versus Kentucky, where he said this should be up to the jury, and that case involved 16-year-olds, made no reference to 15 or younger, but 16-year-olds, the fact that it is a 16-year-old, the jury must be advised of that, and they must be permitted to consider that, but that would trump the jury's decision, Scalia felt was wrong. And actually, it goes back to one of the critical capital punishment cases, which... a case that didn't involve a murder or a death, but set the standards for defining cruel and unusual punishment. It involved a person who lost his citizenship because he had deserted during World War II. This is a 50s case, and Chief Justice Earl Warren defined what cruel and unusual punishment is. He said, "Those words draw their meaning from the evolving standards of decency that mark the progress of a maturing society." And the court has held to that ever since. Over the dissent of Justice Scalia and a number of other justices, it sounds great, but their critique is that allows the Supreme Court to impose its will of what's right and wrong over the will of the people, which in a democracy should not be allowed.
And these are tough calls. I mean, for example, the Christopher Simmons case, we have his confession. Our book links you to videotapes of a lot of events in the book. When you watch Christopher Simmons describe how he throws a woman off a bridge, callously, you wonder about the death sentence.
Incidentally, Leonard, it's one of the features of our book you don't find in too many books. You have QR codes as well as links. You can just plug in the link onto your computer. But if you have a smartphone, you put it over that code, and up will come Chris Simmons' confession as you're reading about it.
My guests are Tim O'Brien, Martin Clancy. Their book, Murder at the Supreme Court, Lethal Crimes and Landmark Cases. It is published by Prometheus Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The court has pretty much always been divided on this issue. Didn't many of the justices worry that the court's rulings on the death penalty weren't clarifying, but were instead making things murkier and muddier?
That was Justice Powell's explanation when, after voting to uphold capital punishment throughout his career, threw up his hand saying, you know, we say one thing one day, and then there's a change in personnel in the court, and we say the opposite. That happened with the admission of victim impact statements, for example. And in theory it works, in practice it doesn't. And we did the right thing, perhaps, in 1976 to reinstate capital punishment, but everything that's happened since then shows that it doesn't work, and we can't make it work.
One thing we discovered throughout is that the justices truly struggle. I mean, it's a battle between what they feel is their duty and their own feelings. There's a classic case of an inmate named Willie Francis, who was condemned to death in Louisiana, which then had a traveling electric chair. They took it to the courthouse in St. Martinville. They hooked up Willie. And as the witness said, Willie didn't go anywhere. The malfunction in the electric chair, which caused only minor burns, took the case to the Supreme Court. Was it double jeopardy to put Willie Francis back in the electric chair? The court voted it was just an accident. that Louisiana could redo it. But Justice Frankfurter was so distressed that he went behind his colleague's back, literally, and tried to get friends in Louisiana to get the sentence at least overturned. He thought it was a travesty. That backdoor play didn't work. Willie Francis was executed a year later.
Evidence that innocent people have been put to death led Illinois to put a 10-year moratorium on executions and then repealed its death penalty law in 2011. The Innocence Project has overturned 18 wrongful convictions of death row inmates. Has this influenced the Supreme Court's rulings on death penalty cases?
It certainly has influenced public opinion. Whether it's influenced the Supreme Court, it does not appear to have. The Supreme Court said that upheld a law in Texas that said if you have new evidence, you got to bring it to the trial court within 30 days of the sentencing. And the U.S. Supreme Court upheld that, saying there has to be finality in judgments. We are finding, however, that while the risk of executing the innocent has always been a consideration in capital punishment debates, that risk is greater than we ever thought it was.
There are also problems with defendants in many cases having access to good lawyers, getting a fair trial. Recently, a case involving whether paperwork had been sent in on time. How has that shaped how the death penalty is applied?
Well, Tim and I both sat in the courtroom for the argument of that case, which I found fascinating. The state attorney general stood up there with his bare face hanging out and said that it was sort of okay that the appellate counsel didn't receive notice of a hearing, that after all, the stuff was postmarked properly. The Supreme Court didn't feel that was accurate.
The Supreme Court has, how has it dealt with people who are mentally ill? It's really hard to make a case of mental illness, isn't it? Obviously, Colorado is going after the Aurora shooter, even though most people would say he probably was seriously ill.
Well, there's a difference between mental illness at the time of execution and insanity. In the case before the Supreme Court, you had someone who was mentally ill at the time of this trial, was found competent to stand trial, but there's a big debate as to whether he was mentally ill or not. The Supreme Court said if he is under state law, then he cannot be executed. He had three juries, 36-0, vote to execute him, and the case went back to a fourth jury to see if he really met any definition of mental retardation. And while that case was pending, it turned up that prosecutors had withheld some evidence at the trial years earlier, and his death sentence was set aside. So the landmark case that bears the name of the defendant, Darrell Atkins was not affected by that decision at all. Here again, though, Leonard, you have that issue. If someone is truly doesn't understand what's going on, nobody really wants to execute him. It's not likely to happen. But if you have someone who's a little on the dim side, a little substandard, some state might say he's retarded, some state may say he's not. In this case, he had an IQ of 70. 70 was the cutoff point. Should that be left to the jury, or is that a question for the judges?
And hasn't there also been a debate over whether somebody is mentally ill, is put on medication, appears at a trial in better shape than he was when he committed the crime?
And what if you don't want to take the medication? What if you're psychotic, as one condemned man was, and refuse medication? Does the state have the right to medicate you so that it can execute you? The Supreme Court took that case. Interestingly enough, they punted. They didn't really decide it. So a lower state Supreme Court in Louisiana decided that it was not kosher to execute somebody, forcibly medicate somebody to execute them.
So right now, if there were a capital case to be decided, are the rules pretty clear?
No. I mean, if you have someone who's, in no respect are they clear insofar as forcible medication is concerned.
I'm just talking about in anything. It seems to me that what we've been saying is that the court keeps on changing its mind, and I have no idea where we are right now.
Well, there's that, and the fact that the states can't make up their mind either. So, frankly, it's a crapshoot.
But you do have this. When it gets to the Supreme Court, death sentences are going to be upheld, because there is none of the nine justices is opposed to it per se on a constitutional basis. So you don't have a majority for throwing it out. So it depends on the individual case. And in states, we have these cases, and you've referred to some of them, where the crime is so horrendous, there's going to be a great deal of support for capital punishment, and it may well happen, as it did with Timothy McVeigh and the Oklahoma City bombings. If you look at the crime and the criminal, it's very easy to support it, and that is true for Supreme Court justices as well as it is for the rest of us. If you look at the system at large, as we did, you have to have some misgivings.
I thank both of you for being on our show. Tim O'Brien, Martin Clancy, their book, Murder at the Supreme Court, Lethal Crimes and Landmark Cases, published by Prometheus Books.
Thank you for having us.
It's a real pleasure.